Good afternoon. Welcome to The LaRouche Show, the internet radio broadcast on www.larouchepub.com, and also this week to The LaRouche Connection, the national cable news broadcast of the LaRouche movement. I'm Michelle Steinberg. I work in the counterintelligence section of the Executive Intelligence Review. And with me today are two very special guests who I've been working with on a team to produce a new study of EIR's groundbreaking work that we did 30 years ago on the international drug trade. What my two guests, Dennis Small, on the editorial board of EIR, and Ben Denniston of the LaRouche PAC, LaRouche Youth Movement editorial and part of the editorial group for the LPAC website, we've worked together to produce a new study for EIR, Britain's Dope Inc., Marker for Humanity's New Dark Age. What you see on the cover of the EIR is a picture of a young Peruvian peasant girl. She's chewing coca leaf. She's chewing coca leaf to anesthetize herself against the hard work, the lack of food, the misery, the miserable conditions of her life in Peru decades ago. This is still going on. This is Britain's opium war against the world. In the 19th century, the British Empire ran such a war against China. A drugged population cannot defend its own interests. Throughout the 20th century, the British Empire spread this opium war against the rest of the world. We're still fighting it today. Just hours ago, Lyndon LaRouche had a conference call with a group of organizers, LaRouche Movement organizers, and editors from EIR, leaders of our editorial group, our LaRouche Youth Movement. And he made very clear, we have one task ahead of us today. Our movement has to fight for the United States against the British Empire. We're going to hear directly from that conference call now.
We are presently in a state of war. It's a war against the British Empire. The United States' existence is being attacked by the British Empire. And we have this crazy fascist former Prime Minister of England, Tony Blair, coming in and brainwashing a bunch of our, not only our citizens, but some of our members of Congress. And we sit back sloppily trying not to upset people when our job is, in a sense, to fight a war against them. You know, I don't want to say that Amity Schles or whatever is really human and therefore we can attack her quite freely. But we're really going after these guys who are acting up, and we are attacking the Liberty League as it exists today. And that's the entire Wall Street-centered crowd, which is conducting the present attack on the President of the United States, but trying to attract not only the President, in the same way that the fascists of the Liberty League Association attacked Roosevelt back in the middle of the 1930s.
Well, Dennis and Ben, you know, from the work we've been doing this week, this has been a very important week for the British Empire. Let me catch our audience up with what we've been following. First of all, Prime Minister Gordon Brown addressed a joint session of Congress, a travesty in itself, but he was here to try and recapture the presidency away from the American people to the British Empire, back in the fold of the British Empire. And the Brits are very, very angry because President Obama didn't have a press conference with him, etc. There's a lot more behind that story, which we'll get into. The second thing is that British agent George Soros, who is a key figure in our battle against Dope Incorporated, pulled off an operation through a institution he created, the International Criminal Court, to float an arrest warrant against Sudan's President Bashir. This travesty of Injustice is a British Empire operation, and we're taking the gloves off. And today's show is especially to make clear in every viewer's mind that the British Empire built itself on the backs of humanity through the international drug trade. And to this day, the British Empire wants every country to stop the drug war. Now, if anybody thought that Lyndon LaRouche was in the least bit exaggerating, I'd like to show The Economist, the London Economist, which came out today. You saw the picture of EIR's magazine, The New Dark Age Through Drugs. The London Economist says, how to stop the drug wars. That fight, those two different positions, is why we published the study on Dope Inc. And I'd like to turn it over to Dennis Small to give us an overview of what the EIR package says on this.
Well, thanks, Michelle. This has been an issue which we've followed and studied and fought in this war for 30 years, as you well know. The British, with allies in different parts around the world, have been intent on using the drug trade internationally today, exactly the way they used the Opium War against China back in the 19th century, for various purposes. And the reason that we came out with this study now reflects those various purposes. First of all, today, we are in the middle of the most enormous, serious collapse of the world financial system that has been seen since the 14th century. This is not a recession. It's not a depression. It is a complete, total meltdown of the entire global international financial system. And one of the crucial ways that the British are trying to save their role as political controllers of this system and to remain dominant is to use the drug trade and the funds from the drug trade, which are very substantial. We're talking about minimally $800 billion a year. I think that's our conservative estimate that we document here, probably closer to $1 trillion. When you add into that the other aspects of the black economy, weapons, prostitution, contraband, and so on, you're talking about a cool $2 trillion in liquid cash which can be used to bolster this bubble. So that's one thing. Excuse me. Another aspect of this is that the British are moving very directly in the very first few weeks of the Obama administration in Washington to try to make sure that the Obama administration does nothing different than the numerous years we spent in the Bushes on the drug war, which is what the Bushes did, was not only didn't they fight it, but they pushed it. They pushed drugs. That's absolutely the case. And what the British want is they don't want Obama breaking from this approach. And they're already highly disappointed by what Obama has done, most recently the actions taken by Attorney General Eric Holder in terms of the raids jointly with Mexico and Canada to bust up the Sinaloa cartel. And it is our intent to make sure that the British are even more disappointed with Obama to get an absolute break in this policy.
Let me stay on the financial side of this that you mentioned first, the world's collapse like the 14th century. In your article in EIR, the introduction to this package, which, by the way, is 46 pages or so long, it includes a history of the British Opium War. It includes a history of how the British invented decriminalization. And it includes various aspects of the war in Afghanistan, which we will get to in this discussion. But in the introduction, Dennis, you say, quoting Lyndon LaRouche, on January 28th, this is doomsday time. The world's available money supply is tied largely to the attempted bailout of financial institutions, and you've got a shortage of money, of any kind of credit, building up rapidly into catastrophic levels in every other area. Now, the argument is that you have to be good to the drug pushers. They're the only ones who are supplying the loose cash for the financial system. How do the British fit into that?
Well, they fit into this because they're the ones who created the whole system, and they created the entire approach around the drug question to tolerate it and to push what is really the most underlying aspect of this, which is that this is cultural warfare. This is menticide. This is the very heart of the British ideology of what the world should look like, which is that human beings should not be human, should not be creative, should not be thoughtful, should not be productive, that they should be like human cattle. And the best way to do that is to get a population completely drugged. And they're the masterminds of that entire approach. Financially, they are the beneficiaries of this as well, precisely because the entire world financial system is simply crumbling at this point. And every effort that has occurred so far, both in the previous administration and many of the things that we still see coming out of Treasury Secretary Geithner, in terms of a generalized channeling of money, including to the cancer, are going to fail because the cancer has become 90, 95, 98% of the world financial aggregates. It's speculative, cancerous garbage. And if you try to issue credit indistinctly and channel funds in the direction of the cancer, what you're going to get is you're going to feed the cancer. You're not going to save the patient. What's needed here on the global financial system, I've often referred to this, the problem with economics is people talk about economics and econometrics and so on. What you need is a new branch of real physical economy which looks at this from the standpoint of cancer, of oncology. So we really need a science of oncology if we're going to deal with this problem today. Cut out the cancer, stop it. What the British are doing is exactly the opposite, and that's where the drug trade comes in. You're talking about $1 to $2 trillion, which may not sound like very much, set up against $1 or $2 quadrillion.
Of derivatives.
Of derivatives and financial aggregates. It's 1/1000th of it. But given the way multiplier effects work, given the way leverage works and so on, and the complete liquidity of this cash, this is one of the main instruments that has been bolstering this gigantic world Ponzi scheme called the international financial system. As we saw in the recent case of Bernie Madoff and his incredible Ponzi scheme, which, lo and behold, what they were doing is they were laundering drug money from Russia and from the Colombian cartels. And that's really a microcosm of the situation we're facing today. We take down Dope Inc., and there's a reason we call it Dope Inc., which we can get to. This is not some supply and demand, market-based bunch of drug runners. This is an international cartel controlled by at the top by the British, which we have called Dope Incorporated, which is what it actually is. Take that down, and you're taking out one of the crucial props under the entire British system. So the declaration of war, which Lynn was just discussing right now, Mr. LaRouche was addressing, is exactly what is behind our thinking on this study on the dope trade as well.
Okay, let's get into the meat of the study that you did. What are the main drugs? Where are they produced? I think if we talk about Mexico and Afghanistan, we're not only talking about places where the economy of the country has been turned over to Dope Inc., but really the governments are at war or completely infiltrated by the drug mobs. So question one, what is narco-terrorism? And in the years of neocons we've been an occupied country with a British-controlled presidency of Bush and Cheney, who are now gone, thank goodness, we were led to believe that the war on terrorism was some religious issue, and we've always believed at EIR, and Mr. LaRouche has proven time again, that narco-terrorism is the driver of this whole operation. How does that look in Ibero-America and Afghanistan, Southwest Asia?
Okay, that's about a dozen questions. Let me pick out a couple of them, and hopefully I'll hit the highlights.
Okay.
Major drugs. You're talking about four major drug groups, which are the opiates, which includes heroin and opium, per se. Second group is the marijuana groups, the cannabis groups, which is marijuana and also hashish, not so much consumed in the United States, more in Europe. Third is cocaine, which people are familiar with. And the fourth are now known as ATS. They used to be called synthetic drugs. Now it's ATS. That's amphetamine-type stimulants. And these are the four major groups. And over the period of the 21st century, from 2000 until the present, our very conservative estimate is that the total street sale value of the amount of drugs that are produced in the world in those four groups, the potential street sale value, because nobody knows if it's all been sold or not, or how it works with the yearly modifications in terms of supply and reserves that they have in stockpiles and so on, but that has gone up from about $550 billion in the year 2000 to $804 billion in 2007. So we're pushing up towards $1 trillion. It probably has gotten there already. Now, the very phrase narco-terrorism is a phrase that was coined by Lyndon LaRouche, 20, 30 years ago, to identify two things. First of all, that drugs is run centrally, internationally, by a unified cartel with the British at the top from the City of London, whose purpose is a war against the world's population. So it's a unified, single operation. And that terrorist forces around the world are not only not distinct from the drug trade, but they are deployed by the same forces, the British imperial forces that are behind the drug trade. And there's not just an occasional casual relationship between, you know, Joe the terrorist and Jose the drug runner or something like that. It is a single unified operation at the top. They have the same mother. They're both bastards, but they have the same mother in this operation. And it's very interesting. Nobody has wanted to even use the phrase narco-terrorism except for LaRouche. The State Department, interestingly, is now edging around to talk about that. And it's actually useful because it's not a semantic question. The issue is that what is behind the Taliban insurgency in Afghanistan is the drug trade. And LaRouche has said it very clearly. You can't get rid of this insurgency unless you first wipe out the drug trade. And we see the same thing all across Ibero-America, the case of Sendero Luminoso in Peru, the case of the FARC in Colombia, and so on. They got the same mother. And that's why they have to be destroyed and gone after in exactly that way.
Okay, but Afghanistan, this is amazing to people who find out about it for the first time, and it's amazing to us, too. Unlike countries where the narcos were better armed and had better technology than the armies, et cetera, this was the case in some of the Ibero-American countries, certainly in Africa today that's the case. In Afghanistan, you have the largest countries with the most sophisticated armies, radar. They can read anything, they can see anything, and yet the opium production has gone up from, 2,000 to 3,000 tons in 2002 to 8,000 tons in 2007, under the noses, or as you put it, the watchful eye of NATO and the allies. So what's going on?
Well, what's going on is that the British, stiff upper lip and all, are turning a blind eye and a happy blind eye to what's happening directly under their noses. I mean, if we were talking about cocaine, we could be more accurate and say that it's under their noses. In the case of opium and heroin, maybe the metaphor should be different. But the opium is produced, two-thirds of the opium of Afghanistan is produced in Helmand province. Helmand province is run by the British. It's the British army there. It is a NATO deployment. That's absolutely true. But the British not only are there and are watching and are protecting this thing, but they have argued forcefully, violently, nastily, every time an American patriotic impulse expresses itself and says, hey, why don't we just wipe this out, like recently General Craddock and what he said. And the British went berserk, and they tried to stop the idea that you have to go after the drug trade if you're serious about stopping Taliban. See, it is shocking. The numbers are shocking. I mean, it sent a chill up my spine, as it did up yours and any reasonable person who looks at these numbers. When you just can't believe that this is going on. But it should not be actually surprising. Why? Because this is not a result of supply and demand. And people really have to understand this concept. The use of the phrase dope incorporated has a fundamental concept behind it. This is a deliberate, intentional policy. It is being pushed at the top. It is being pushed at the top by the British, as they have for centuries. They are taking targeted populations. They are managing the market. They are reducing prices as necessary to expand the market. This whole idea that if you lower prices, it's going to be less profitable and less violent, baloney. I mean, let me just make a parenthetical point on this thing. The argument that comes from those who defend drug legalization, or one of the arguments, is, well, if we legalize, that will make the whole trade less profitable because you will lower prices. And there are charts in our publications here which show what's actually happened. Because the argument is, well, if you lower prices enough, it won't be profitable, and therefore it won't be so much money and not so violent. Well, the fact of the matter, for any person who would care to simply do the basic charting of price and quantity as we have done over the decades with the major drug groups, will see that the prices of cocaine, of marijuana, and of heroin have dropped over decades deliberately. It has been done as a marketing strategy by Dope Inc. because by lowering prices, you expand the market. And their profits have increased because the market increases by more than the price reduction. So when the drug runners hear the argument coming from these people who say, oh, we have to legalize to lower the prices because that'll stop the drug runners, they sit back and they laugh and they say, make my day. And that's exactly the problem with this whole argument. It's run centrally. It's deliberate. They take target populations. They start with the youth. You know, this idea that somehow there's always going to be consumption because people have this natural propensity to consume drugs. Don't tell me that an 8 or 9 or 10-year-old child has a propensity to consume heroin or marijuana. It's not true. It's being deliberately imposed on them. It's as if they took a funnel and poured this stuff down people's throats. It's a form of torture. And that's what's actually going on. And that's the reason why when you see something like Afghanistan, which you were remarking before, you have to see the hand of an intentional policy of flooding the world with drugs. And that is what's now going on. And the heroin side of it has been noticed to a significant degree. I want to raise the flag on the question of marijuana. Because people say, well, marijuana, it's not the biggest deal in the world. That's baloney, bunkum, it's not true. Marijuana, the potency of marijuana now is twice what it was in terms of THC content. It's highly addictive, and it is used as a gateway drug by Dope Inc. to make sure that they have an expanding market. This is marketing. This is Harvard 101 Business Administration marketing. Which, by the way, also came from the British. So that should be shut down as part of our campaign on doping.
Okay, I want to turn to a very important figure in this whole drug fight, which both of you know a great deal about, who, well, we don't know if he's a real human being either, who is George Soros. I mentioned him briefly in terms of the International Criminal Court and the attack on national sovereignty. But the LaRouche Youth Movement some time ago wrote and published a pamphlet through LPAC, Ben, called Your Enemy, George Soros. Why don't you give us an overview of Soros, and then let's go right at what's his role in this dope traffic?
Well, he's, across the board, he's just the leading figure for Dope Inc. for the British right now. He's playing a specific role. It is significant, actually, that he's been kind of pushed to the side a little bit with this Obama administration, but he's played a certain role in trying to really push this policy into the United States specifically, but legalization, the drug legalization question, he's all over it, around the world pushing the legalization of drugs. He's also tied into a lot of these cartels and drug running, illegal drug running rings. So he fully represents the Britain's doping policy, and also he's basically being handled by a guy out of the British Foreign Office, Lord Moloch Brown, who's also involved in this whole ICC policy against attempts to take down Bashir in Sudan. So he just completely represents this British imperial policy. And one thing I think it's worth bringing up just in this whole discussion about the intentional targeting of the populations is that Lyndon LaRouche put out a policy some months back that if we're going to actually address and solve this economic crisis, it's going to require the four most powerful nations in the world to come together and create a system that's going to be explicitly opposed to British imperial free trade under the guise of globalization. and move the world back into a system of sovereign nations. He called this his four powers proposal. He says that the United States, Russia, India, and China should come together, form a new agreement to then move the world out of this collapsing system into the future. And I think it's significant to note that some of the biggest nations being targeted by the drug trade and by the narco-terrorism are these four powers. You look at these recent attacks in Mumbai, India. Right, a lot of the money and logistics coming out of this came right out of these drug narco-terrorist networks. You look at the Afghan drug trade. A lot of this is being flooded into Russia, for example. So it's important to just emphasize that note that this is a political operation, an intentional operation being pushed by the British, by the Empire, for these strategic objectives at this point.
Right. Now, we can say a lot more. I'd like to say a few things about Soros's role in the whole fight for decriminalization and so forth, but there's another aspect. He's really, really active in Latin America with his Three Stooges, three former presidents, and targeting the United Nations meeting coming up, Dennis, which I think your team has worked on a great deal.
Yeah, I mean, I really don't like to refer to them as the Three Stooges because it gives them much too much credit. I mean, these guys, we're talking about the former presidents of Brazil, Fernando Henrique Cardoso, Gaviria of Colombia, and Cedillo of Mexico. These guys destroyed their countries when they were president by exactly this policy of free trade and globalization. They introduced and tolerated the whole British free trade doctrine, which, by the way, directly opens the door to the drug trade. You talk to border governors in the United States or people in the DEA and so on, and they'll tell you that this NAFTA business, if they had a difficult job before, it's now impossible because everything just goes back and forth. Drugs come up, money goes down, and weapons go down. Very, very serious quantity of weapons and caliber of weapons. In fact, it would seem to be the case that the caliber of some of these weapons going into Mexico is so high that it is not simply the sort of things that you can get at gun shows or gun shops, but are military issue. And that's a really serious problem. So these three ex-presidents, after having spent, you know, 5 to 10 productive years destroying their countries on behalf of the British imperial system, were then recruited into George Soros's Latin American Commission on Drugs and Democracy, which is calling for drug legalization. And you have these three guys, rather than calling them, you know, more than clowns, they're real SOBs, and they are the ones who are serving as the front men for the promotion of drug legalization in a debate all over the place. Really interesting that the president of Mexico, Calderon, who himself had some questions and was toying with the idea of drug legalization, has just recently, in the last couple of weeks, come down like a ton of bricks on this idea of drug legalization and attacked ex-president Cedillo almost by name, referring to former presidents and so on, who now promote drug legalization. So Soros is very active on that side, and he's extremely active on the U.S. side, as you know, and since you know much more about this than I do, let me ask you, reversing the roles here. No, because this is really crucial, because as we know, Soros has financed every single effort to legalize drugs in the United States. But this is not something in the past. It's ongoing right now, and if I'm not mistaken, California is really right at the center of the battle at this point.
Well, yeah. You know, first of all, let me take it from the top. Back when we first produced Dope Incorporated in 1978, the book created an organization in the United States called the National Anti-Drug Coalition, and we had a magazine called War on Drugs. And at that time, the drug lobby was financed by the Playboy Foundation. It was financed by a commodities trader, Richard Dennis. And behind the scenes, some of the key economists like Milton Friedman, a fascist from the University of Chicago, who was the fascist ideologue behind Pinochet of Chile. He was just he was too young to be Hitler's finance minister, so they had to use Jean-Marc Schacht. But they tried to make the argument for drug decriminalization at that time. We stopped it in its tracks. In the mid-90s, you know, just state after state after state, if you remember, we fought drug decriminalization. One of our collaborators, Dr. Ned Rosinsky wrote for War on Drugs about marijuana is not harmless. And he's actually doing some research now to update that story. Then in the middle 1990s, at the point that they were really pushing for free trade, they were really pushing for a total destruction of the nation-state system of economy, free trade, Soros came in with billions of dollars to set up institutions like the Open Society Institute, the Drug Policy Foundation, etc. And since that time, they've been trying to get legalization through. Now, back in 1996, Soros has a full-time pothead, Dr. Ethan Nadelman from the London School of Economics, who's, you know, he's a baby boomer, and he dedicates his whole life to talking nothing except dope, dope, dope. And we call him the Big Dope, Soros' Big Dope. I just watched him speak at the Cato Institute a few weeks ago, and he was bragging about the importance of the Latin American League for Democracy and Drugs and so forth that you were just referencing, saying three former presidents now understand that prohibition never works, etc. And he said we're in a paradigm shift because we've managed to win the fight on medical marijuana. We could use that as a stepping stone. If it's going to be medicine, then we have to legally produce it and sell it, et cetera. So they've had this step-by-step process. I'm happy to say that, as Ben mentioned in passing, Soros has been sort of pushed aside a little bit by the Obama administration. And we, the LaRouche movement, have had some serious victories on this question of drugs and fighting drugs right up against Soros. For one thing, we're told that the United Nations 100th year anniversary meeting of trying to control illegal narcotics trade is completely rejecting this Soros argument of let us not try to eliminate drugs, let's just try and reduce the harm that it does to people. Like, heroin's not bad enough. We're going to worry about clean needles? I mean, heroin, shooting heroin into your veins is going to kill you. So what's the harm reduction in that? Eliminate the drugs, right? No, they wanted to go for harm reduction. We're told, and we'll see if it bears out or not, that this has been rejected by the United Nations. That was one victory. A second victory, this was a big one. General Craddock, the supreme commander of the NATO troops, has authorized the military forces under his command to target the drug traffickers in Afghanistan, because we have absolutely firm, hard intelligence that the money from those proceeds is providing billions of dollars to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban insurgents. So it was a victory to allow the American-led troops in Afghanistan to go after the drug trade. Until a couple of months ago, that was not permitted. And then, inside the United States, specifically impacting on California, there was a major arrest announced by Attorney General Eric Holder and by DEA Administrator Michelle Leonhardt of the members of the Sinaloa cartel, but I think it's much broader than that. There's another cartel known as the Gulf Cartel, I understand, and hundreds and hundreds of people from these two cartels operating in U.S. cities have been arrested. And this is just the beginning. So the Soros forces are defensive. They're freaked out, but they are going to counterattack. They have a lot more money than we do. You know, Soros is willing to put billions of dollars into this fight worldwide to legalize a form of slavery. And his whole apparatus, all his foundations, from Human Rights Watch to the Open Society Institute to the Soros Foundation, and he brags that he operates in 30 countries, they're all dedicated to legalizing drugs. So that's what we're up against. He's a British agent People can read our dossiers on the LaRouche PAC and the LaRouche PAC websites and get the story for themselves.
Can I add one point on Soros, this is by way of grammatical clarification? People think that his name is spelled S-O-R-O-S. In point of fact, the proper spelling is S-S-O-R-O-S, with the emphasis on the S-S. Now, for those of you who don't understand the reference, George Soros was trained by the Nazis when he, as a Jew in occupied Hungary, worked for the Nazis against fellow Jews and defends that activity to this day, saying that this was the part of his life that was character-forming, he enjoyed it, it was adventurous, and the argument is, hey, if I hadn't done it, somebody else would have. So George Soros is not only a drug runner, not only a mega speculator, not only spells his name SS, but the guy was Nazi-trained and is a Nazi to this day. That's who this guy actually is.
Okay, we are in our last half-hour segment, well into our last half-hour segment. Ben has a question, and I really want to elaborate our economic alternative. So, Ben, why don't you go ahead first?
Yeah, useful raising for the discussion, because there's a lot of argument that, and it kind of got touched on before, that the drug trade just is always going to be there. There's always going to be a demand for it. You can't shut it down. So maybe just to address that right now, can we actually eliminate and shut down the drug trade?
Yes, absolutely. The same way you can absolutely eliminate and shut down the British mother of this whole drug trade, the entire British imperial system. We can defeat this thing. Not only can we have to, or we're going to be facing a new dark age of the sort that we faced in the 14th century, only this time the face of that little Peruvian girl that Michelle was showing previously from the cover of our magazine is going to be the case not only of millions of people as it is today, it's going to be the story for billions around the planet. That is the face of the new dark age. Now, there's a couple of ways that this thing has to be addressed on the war on drugs. First of all, from a high technology standpoint, yes, lethal force has to be used, but Mr. LaRouche has emphasized over and over again that there are high technology capabilities which can be wielded and must be wielded, where the role of the United States is absolutely critical. Our best estimate is that at the level of eradication of drug crops, you can get rid of probably 90% of the crop with sophisticated detection and eradication techniques, using satellite detection, using aerial spraying, and so on. You can wipe out 90% of the marijuana, 90% of the coca, 90% of the poppy plantations. Of the 10% that remains, you can then use advanced technologies for interdiction and seizures of drugs. You have to be able to rapidly and accurately scan the millions of incoming containers into the United States, which is where the drugs come from. People have this kind of Hollywood misperception that, you know, the drugs come across an unprotected, unguarded part of the border with Mexico in the dark of night with one guy swimming across the river with a pack of heroin on his back. That happens. But most of the drugs that enter the United States enter through the main ports of entry of the international trade. There are millions of containers which you simply cannot hand scan, search. So you need sophisticated technologies like MRI technologies, nuclear magnetic resonance technologies that are used in medicine, and other forms of technologies. That applied, you can probably knock out 70% of the 10% that's remaining. And then, of course, so that already gets you down to 2 to 3% of what you were starting with, which is a significant effort. And then, of course, you've got to go after the financial side. You've got to monitor the finances. You've got to shut this thing down. You've got to shut down everything that is involved in this disintegrating world financial system. So those are the measures that can be taken. It's absolutely doable. What you have to do at the same time, you see, there's a change over the last 10 years from the last time that we did our big study on this and our previous publications. You now have millions and millions of people that are effectively slaves of the international drug trade, who produce, who are involved in the economy. And that's because the world financial system and physical economy has imploded, has been disintegrating. You go to a place like Afghanistan or to Bolivia or Mexico, the only thing going is drugs, because we've allowed everything else to be destroyed. So that immediately tells you what the economic side of this is, which is, I believe, what your question is addressing. You absolutely have to, at the same time that you go after and completely eradicate drugs, which you can do, you have to immediately, even before the fact, introduce a developing, productive economy which can employ the people who are today the slaves of the drug trade. I'll give you an example. I just read a report this morning that, according to U.S. Department of Defense statistics, there are 100,000 foot soldiers of the drug cartels in Mexico. 100,000. There are 130,000 members of the Mexican armed forces. They're outgunned. And that's just the foot soldiers. The economy, you're talking millions of people whose only way to survive is somehow tied into this drug trade. It's not that they're in favor of drugs. It's the only thing going. So if we build the NAWAPA, the North American Water and Power Alliance, and the PLINO, the Northwest Hydraulic Plant of Mexico, you bring huge quantities of water into the Great American Desert. You irrigate agricultural land. You start producing with advanced technologies the food that's required. You introduce nuclear energy to desalinate water and to produce the energy that's required. You build high-speed maglev railroads throughout this area. Everything that's in LaRouche's plan, and which is exactly the basis for the alliance of the four powers that you were referring to, then you are building the kind of economic basis which substitutes what has now become what these people simply have to depend on. They're hooked on this. It's not their choice. They're hooked on it. And we have to provide an alternative, and it's absolutely doable. So that the kind of cooperation that you were referring to before of the four-power alliance, China, Russia, India, and the United States, is crucial in terms of the development project. Curiously enough, that same alliance is absolutely critical. If you want to seriously shut down drugs in Afghanistan, that's who's got to work together. Those are the interested parties. So we have a common enemy. We have a basis for working, even with countries that we have ideological differences with, like Iran. The Cheney policy on Iran is nuts. The Bush policy is nuts. And we have to go to build a basis with countries that we may have disagreements with, but we can agree on one or two basic things. No go on drugs, no go on the British Empire. We need to build an economic alternative. So if you do all of those things, which is what LaRouche laid out back in 1985 in his 15-point war plan, you can absolutely shut this thing down. The idea that somehow it's undefeatable and that we can't win and let's throw in the towel, and this is just pessimism. It's cultural pessimism, and it's intolerable under conditions of warfare. Anyone who starts to think that way should treat themselves to a dose of a 10-second look at the cover of this magazine of ours, of EIR, and see if they can, after looking at that young girl's vacant, wandering, desperate eyes, if they can look at themselves in the mirror and say, oh, let's not fight. We have to fight. And if you fight, you can win. If you don't fight, of course you're not going to win. That's, I think, the way we have to look at it.
Yeah, I'd like to just add an historic note because of this 100 years ago. There was a conference in Shanghai, China, and at that time the British fought very, very hard to keep marijuana legal, and I think they actually succeeded for another 4 years. In 1912, there was another conference where the majority of countries, and these were third world countries, Turkey, Egypt, they came and said, look, these drugs are killing our population. We cannot become what we can become if our population is stupefied and zombified. And, you know, the British Empire, to stop the revolt against drugs in the 1890s, actually created something called the famous India Hemp Commission study. And they brought in plantation owners, basically slave owners. It would be like asking the slave owners prior to the American Civil War if slavery was a good economic system, because the plantation owners in India just boasted about how wonderful the coolies could perform by using cannabis, because they didn't feel any pain, which is the point about this young girl in Peru.
Yeah.
Right? if you're doing back-breaking work and you're stupefied, you're drugged, you don't feel the pain, you don't feel the physical pain, you don't feel the mental pain, you can't think, you cannot be creative. And then what happened is the world revolted against the British Empire on the question of drugs and outvoted the Brits again and again and again, so that in 1925, cannabis was made illegal, and that's what the Brits are trying to change to this day. Now, the first decriminalization argument actually came from the British Parliament in 1968. It was called the Wooten Commission, Baroness Barbara Wooten, and they had various organizations in Britain that then spread to the United States to become the dope lobby, which is owned by Soros today. But this idea of drugging the population and killing creativity is really important. And there's another argument now in the Depression, which is that, well, in the last Depression, ending the prohibition against alcohol was very important because people said, oh, we need money so much for the states. We can tax this consumption and thereby finance our schools, et cetera, et cetera. Now, this is writ large in California, where you have Arnie Schwarzenegger, Ben. You probably have some anecdotes to tell us about that, where I think it's Assemblyman Amiano has come up with a bill for full legalization and taxation of illegal marijuana trade. So how's it look out there in terms of...
Well, it's we have to crush it. I mean, it's I think the... To take it from the highest point, it really is just an absurd idea about how you organize society and economics and fundamental questions of human nature. I mean, if you're just saying all we need is some way to get more money and then we can get out of this crisis and, you know, who cares if it's drugs? I mean, if all you have to do is legalize something, then it's going to be good. You know, why not legalize crime? Or murder, right? Is that going to make it all of a sudden good for society? You could tax it or something. You know, maybe make murder really expensive, make a bunch of money off that. I mean, it's just, the point that is being made is it destroys creativity. It enslaves a population mentally. And as we've been discussing, this is the way the empire controls. They destroy and bestialize populations and make it so they don't even have the ability to recognize what's being done to them. They're being controlled by a foreign force, then they're not able to fight back. And so it's part of this whole thing. It just needs to be, you know, we need to continue to lead this fight and just eliminate this thing. And the only real economic recovery is going to come from the kind of program that Mr. LaRouche has been putting forward and that we're backing, of actually improving society's power and through new technologies. And progressing through things like nuclear power, increased water management, these forms of actually upshifting society's technological and scientific capabilities and existence, and orienting your society towards developing the creative powers of every single individual to be able to participate and facilitate that process. I mean, that's what it means to be human. That's the future. This idea that we're going to make money by taxing drugs and somehow prosper through that is just absurd. Yeah, you know, maybe Schwarzenegger believes it, but that's not saying much, you know.
Well, it's their version of a stimulus plan. I think that they think that a stimulus plan means you take stimulants. That seems to be Nancy Pelosi's view of the matter.
Right. So. Well, Dennis, isn't the case study of Colombia a proof that this can the war on drugs can be effective without a fascist state or committing mass murder?
Yeah, if it's done the right way, and I want to pick up on what Ben was just saying, because I think this really goes to the heart of it. This issue of somehow if you tax it or you get some money from it, the argument absolutely holds. Well, let's just legalize murder. Why not? I mean, and, you know, make money that way. But you see, the way the drug trade has always worked has been this thing which is known as silver or lead. It's an old story. It goes back to Colombia and other mafia tactics. The mafia in the morning puts an envelope in your office. If you're a politician, they want to have on their payroll, and the envelope has a couple of $100 bills in it. And in that same envelope is a picture of your daughter coming out of her third grade class, taken with a telephoto lens and right in the crosshairs. The message is very clear. You either take our silver or you're going to get our lead. And there's no discussion. Once that politician buys that argument, it's all over. And that's how these guys work. The whole discussion of drug legalization combined with this incredible level of violence and terror that's going on is the exact same strategy of silver or lead. Now, to defeat this thing, you absolutely have to go at it from the standpoint, I believe, of what you were saying, which is, what is a human being? What does it mean? What are we actually fighting for? Are human beings potential drug consumers and brainless, burnt-out individuals without a soul? Or are they creative people who can contribute to society? The way you fight the war on drugs is critical, because what has been shown, as in the Columbia case, and this is the heart of LaRouche's proposal, is that this has to be done in a way in which you defend exactly that which the British are trying to destroy. First of all, this idea of man as being ultimately creative, and secondly, a world order coming from the Treaty of Westphalia, where you have an international order of sovereign nation states who have a relationship of respect and with each other and who help to develop on the basis of the other's best interest. The British are out to destroy this. They want a single worldwide system. They want to destroy the nation state. And in the war on drugs, we have to have this issue very clearly in mind, because contrary to what some people tell you, it's not only possible, it's necessary to win this war on drugs on the basis of cooperation among sovereign nations where the sovereignty and the national identity of your partners in this war is absolutely respected. What the British try to do is they say, well, anyone who wants to fight drugs in the United States, what they're really talking about is invading Mexico with Mexican troops. And then they whip up all of the, you know, foolish local leftists in Mexico to say, down with the war on drugs and stop the invasion and so on. That's not the way it has to be done or should be done. It has to be done the way it has been proposed by some people coming out of the Obama administration, and as LaRouche was talking about previously, which is you have countries that cooperate based on their common interest. And the United States has crucial elements to provide in this thing, which is technology, intelligence, and an overall political commitment to go after this, especially the financial side. If we do that, I know that we will find in other countries, like Colombia, like Mexico, like Afghanistan, we will find patriots who are absolutely intent on saving their countries, and they will look to the United States. They'll look to the United States of Washington, of Lincoln, of Roosevelt, and of LaRouche as their ally in saving their countries from what otherwise is a new dark age. So if we have that image in our mind of our objective, of creative human beings and a world system based on the nation state, that's the basis on which we can win this war.
A few hours ago, and I think both of you were at the meeting conference call with LaRouche, Mr. LaRouche said, we're going to start every morning. We're going to have Reveille. The bugle call is going to call us to war against the British Empire. And we're going to defend the American Republic against a British assault on the presidency. What was he talking about, the British assault on Obama, and what can the American population do in working with us to join this fight, to stop doping, but even more broadly, to wipe imperialism off the face of the earth as Franklin Roosevelt wanted to do it?
Well, Ben, you want to take it first?
Sure. I mean, we have the policy to do it. It's laid out very clearly, laying out here on our websites, LaRouchePAC.com, LaRouche Pub. We have the policy. I mean, the most first thing that should be in the front of all of this economic crisis. And we're at war. People have to realize, if they're too doped up to realize it, then, you know, that's why the British push Soros out there. But we're already at war, whether people realize it or not. The very existence of this form of sovereign nation-state system where populations are protected and can develop independent of being oppressed by some backwards imperial force. The very existence of that type of system is being threatened right now with this economic breakdown, with the action of the British. So we're at war. We're in the middle of this war. If people want to win, then they should fight with us. We have more elaboration of the policy on our websites. People can contribute and join our organization. And we need to just continue to build a mass political movement that's going to force the institutions of the United States to go with the policies we need and to fight this war on the highest level.
I think I was very struck by Mr. LaRouche's most recent set of documents on the concept of physical space-time, because what he said in there was that, among other things, these are the most important documents that have been written in recent history that empower us or give us the concepts necessary to win this war, to stop this destruction that's now going on. And what he develops, just to try to capture it in one phrase, one feature of this thing, is that the way you change the present is that you act based on human creativity and free will to deliberately change the future and the image you have of the future such that that, in fact, in turn, changes the current situation. If we have a clear concept of what the future has to be, of what this country was made for, the founding concepts in the nature of the individual as being endowed with this capacity of creativity, which no other part of creation has, on the one hand, and on the other hand, the concept of a world order based on nation states, which facilitates the developments of individuals in that way. If we understand clearly that that's what we need to create, that gives you the basis for changing the present. That future activity changes the present situation to obliterate the main enemy of that concept and that form of organization of humanity. The British are the enemy of humanity. Their concept of man is the enemy of humanity. And we have to stop this, and we can stop this if we mobilize people to that future image of what we must become. Not on petty little things. The little battles have to be fought. But if we mobilize and organize people around a conception of what humanity can be, what we actually are, then this drug question and the British in general could just be wiped off the map and we can move forward.
Thank you for joining us. This has been the LaRouche Connection. You summed it up perfectly. Join our war against the British Empire. Contact the LaRouche organization through our websites and at 1-800-929-7566. This is Michelle Steinberg from EIR. Thanks for joining us.